Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, and this week we return to Middle-earth to The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey. I'm joined by a couple of long-time contributors to the VFX show and good friends, starting with you, Mark Christensen. How are you, sir?
Great. Pleasure to be with you tonight.
And Jason Diamond from the other side of America.
In exactly the same pleasure.
But different time zone.
Yes.
There's a lot to talk about with this film, and I think it may be one of the most looked forward to or anticipated VFX shows in a while. I've certainly had a lot of traffic at my end, people saying they're really interested to hear our views on the film. We're going to break it down like this. We're going to discuss The Hobbit, what we thought of the film, which I think invariably is going to spill immediately into a discussion of the high frame rate. That is going to be a bit camera and experientially focused. We're going to then move from there to the VFX work as we normally do. But just to warn you, we do anticipate, I mean, it's the elephant in the room to just talk about the high frame rate. So I think we'll cover that en route to the VFX. But by the same token, it's completely valid to talk about the visual effects independent of the high frame rate. So let's start with just our general. We walked out of the cinema. What did we think, Jason Diamond?
I liked the film. Had some weird parts, you know, weird like modern colloquial language, like out of the frying pan into the fire, which I'm pretty sure Tolkien didn't write, but that's okay. But I like the film overall. It's basically Fellowship Part 2. You know, it's another setup for a long, unexpected journey.
I guess we need to judge this. We need to judge this as a film. I think, obviously, it comes from a very strong literary background. But as we tend to do with all the shows, the films we talk about on this show, we're just going to judge it as a film because I think if you get too bogged down on is it accurate to the book or not, that can be a deal, right? I mean, if you literally but just for general purpose, and for a general, because you know clearly there's a lot of things that you can take. I mean, I've seen a film recently where the director gave me an insight into the film after the film was over. But as a friend of mine once pointed out, you really can only come out of the film with what the film gives you, and then this whole extra layer is an extra layer. Mark,
you know, on the whole, I thought it was really taking a really great book and getting bogged down in overindulgence. So I really didn't think that much to the film as a whole, while I did think it had some really totally just standout work in it that I loved.
Okay, so it's a film that's like about 3 hours long, or at least it felt like about 3 hours long. And it's a film that complete an arc in the first film, do we think, from a narrative point of view? In other words, is this just a giant setup, or did you feel like there was a middle and ending to this beginning, or was it just a beginning?
It was funny. I remember reading this book as a kid, and the book only really kicked in for me once Gollum showed up, and that was pretty much the same in this movie, which unfortunately, because of the way they decided to do it, is a good 3/4 of the way through the film. I didn't totally feel like it was I did. At the end, I definitely felt like it was a to-be-continued ... And, you know, it did complete an arc of sorts, but not really. I think it spent the first hour. I mean, essentially, you got the inciting event in the prologue. And then the first hour was spent debating about whether the inciting event was really an inciting event and what does it really mean if we treat it like an inciting event and, oh, do we really have to go on? You know, and it was very true to the book.
So, Jason, I criticized King Kong for being overly indulgent and including stuff into that film that I thought, well, sourced from the original film, the dinosaur sequence, just really was indulgent. Did you feel this way about Hobbit?
I mean, I kind of agree with Mark to a certain extent. I did like the film. You know, I have the general comment of this that I did of Lord of the Rings, which is, why don't they just call the freaking eagles right from Hobbiton and fly them to the Lonely Mountain? But that's a whole separate thing. But
maybe you didn't have a spare butterfly.
What?
Maybe you didn't have a spare butterfly.
I think there's tons of butterflies in Hobbiton.
Okay.
In the Shire, rather. But anyway, Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to show. It's an interesting show all the or not even fully show Smaug, but show the desolation of the dwarf kingdom right up front, and then jump into funny times with the dwarves set up, and then go into the drama. Whereas they could have wrapped the Smaug stuff and that into the when the dwarves were explaining to Bilbo why they need to go back. I mean, that would have been a tighter potential story rollout. But I mean, it didn't seem self-indulgent in any more than any of the other movies do. The other Lord of the Rings films, that, I mean, it's an epic journey, right? So it has to be 3 hours. It has to feel like insurmountable odds at every turn because they're walking to the other side of, you know, the map. And so, I mean, I don't know. I think if I saw it again, I'd probably be like, oh, this part again for one or two parts. But overall, I mean, when it's dipped, they threw in a fun action sequence with like the trolls or the Goblin King, and that, you know, there were some huge set pieces that just blew any possible dip of boredom out into the, you know, blew it out of the water.
Okay, so for my money, this didn't feel particularly long and laborious. And if you took out the book and the fact that this was only the first six chapters, I felt that the film, you know, went along at a good pace. It wasn't, to me, feeling like it was laborious. It certainly wasn't feeling to me like it was ridiculous. It only gets that kind of framing if you frame it in terms of, well, here's the book and we only got up to here in the book. If you leave that out of it, I don't think, and certainly the people I saw it with didn't think, that the film labored and just, and like the set pieces didn't seem to be, as was my criticism with the dinosaurs and King Kong, just a complete nothing to do with anything, off to one side. Can we get back to the story now, please? Like, I didn't feel that with the trolls. Like, the trolls didn't feel like, well, we're just wasting time here. It just felt like a really good piece, and I appreciated the humor that they provided. So I would say that the film felt like part of a trilogy, but so, you know, sort of,
yeah, it's not a complete story. I mean, you couldn't end there,
yeah,
certainly.
But then you couldn't end the second Star Wars film with Luke with his hand cut off, and you couldn't, you know. There are some films that finish that way, maybe because they're not designed as parts of trilogy. I mean, Godfather Part Two is completely an end unto itself, and we wish that Raiders 3 had finished on its third one. But, you know, apart from that, like, you know, there are just films that are self-contained, and there are films that clearly are... I mean, I didn't have a criticism of... Harry Potter, the last film split into two sections, I understand, you know, just gives you more to a certain extent. Okay, so from my money, the film worked as a film, and also, quite frankly, I didn't sort of start looking at my watch or start pondering, you know, when I was going to get out of here. Or it felt kind of long, but I just don't, maybe I'm getting old, I just don't like sitting in cinemas for that long for a movie full stop, whether it was a complete story or not. But I thought it, you know, cracked along at a pretty good pace. And I think the humor really helped that. Mark?
You know, I took my kids to this movie, and they ranked it right alongside John Carter of Mars for how engaged they felt in it. Yeah. And I definitely saw other members of the audience looking at their iPhones to check. This is San Francisco, after all, to check the time. So I don't think I was alone in feeling that, and to me that's a crime, because it's I think the difference between The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, well, crime might be overstating it, but it, you know, the Hobbit is a children's story, and I was quite engaged by it when I read it as, I don't know, I think I was an eighth grader, and, you know, I really didn't get too far into The Lord of the Rings by comparison, so I could see the heavy-handed treatment of those films because they're rather epic. But to me, I don't know, I was tempted to call this the Phantom Menace of the Tolkien movies, but no, that's not really accurate. But, you know, actually, if it had the Phantom Menace, my kids might have liked it more, but it really wasn't all that much fun.
Yeah, my kids loved it, and no one thought that it dragged.
Interesting.
Yeah, but that's okay. Like, that's a, you know, it's a valid opinion. But, okay, so... So that's it at that level. Let's switch to 48 frames, because that's where I think things are going to start really heating up. So I'll start with you, Mark. This film breaks new ground. It's 3D at a higher frame rate. No one's ever seen a feature film at this duration running at this rate before. Win or fail?
Fail.
Jason?
Super fail.
Super fail. Okay, so I'm
for the reason of a narrative film, and it's not as a technology. It definitely has uses. I don't want to go on record as being uses. Like screw 48 frames or higher frame rate for anything. Just for
are
movies,
we going to talk about Brainstorm?
Me, no.
Well, we could.
Sorry.
Well, it is worth citing. I mean, first of all, I don't. Should I take
yeah,
the first swing at this? We see high frame rate material all the time. It's not like this is a new thing. If we watch, at least in the US, if we're watching TV, more often than not, we're seeing 60 fields or 60 frames or, you know, sometimes 30, but we're seeing more than 24. And so it's not that this is a novel thing. And in the movie Brainstorm, you know, I think the reason to cite that and then throw it away is there it was used, 60 frames in film was used for the effect of putting on a virtual reality helmet and being in this altered reality. And I would say that's getting closer to an appropriate use of what this was for me, because I was distracted throughout the whole movie by it.
Okay, well, here's my thought on it, right? Firstly, and many of these thoughts aren't original because you know, a lot of people that I really trust and value around the net have been talking about this. And Zap in particular has had some really good posts on it, but Paul Franklin's been twittering about it, doing some really good stuff. Stu's been posting some good stuff. So I'm not claiming these are original thoughts, but I agree that the cinematic aspect, the thing that you would describe as this looking really cinematic, went away. But I should also point out that that goes away for me when I go into 3D. If we were just talking about 48 frames without 3D, it would be a different discussion. And that's where I call foul on your comment, Mark, which is you don't often see 3D 48 frames. You're seeing television running in mono at 48 or 50 or 60 or whatever we want to talk about it at. But we're not seeing stereo. So for me, the second I put on the glasses and I see immersive 3D, it doesn't look as cinematic as something that's just shot normally, and whether it be digitally or film, and just played at 24. So that's point number one. And so if you're going to go into this idea of, oh, I want to immerse you in the world, and the second that you go into 3D, I have some issues with 3D. I don't particularly, like, I'm not a big advocate of 3D. And so while I've seen some spectacularly good stuff, especially from Pixar, I think that the frame rate bothers me more in 3D than it does, you know, like putting on glasses in 3D, the frame rate becomes an issue. So the idea of going up to 48 frames seemed like a good idea from that perspective. And also creatively, I have to say, I don't think the filmmaker wanted it to look cinematic in that traditional sense. Otherwise, he wouldn't have done 3D and he wouldn't have done 48 frames. He wanted a different thing. This is an immersive 3D experience in a fantasy world. And that's not the yardstick of, does this look as good as a normal 24 frame a second film, especially if it was shot on film. Like, he didn't want that look. He didn't go for that look.
That's fair. But for me personally, and my assumption is that the part of the 48 frame discussion in the production side would be that because they're going stereo, the more frames, the less eye strain and judder and all the other problems that come along with 24 frame stereo. So I can see why they would do that. Plus, they had the kit to do it. But for me, immersive cinematic, and I'm using that term to be mean not television, basically, is the 48 frames. Just it also may be that I'm just not used to it. But it bothered me the whole time, like Mark, like the whole first act at Bilbo's desk while he's writing and in the house felt like it was playing at 1.5 times speed to me, which is the edits seemed weird and things seemed rushed. And I'm not saying that it is that way, but that was the perception to me. And it really bothered me for a while. And while I felt like when you go into the Goblin King's lair, it looks ridiculous. I mean, it's insane how much you're seeing, but I want my suspension of disbelief happens when, for me, not when it looks more real. So it was harder for me to get into it personally that way. I mean, I'm going to see this in probably all three flavors, 24 flat, 24 3D, and I've already seen the high frame rate 3D. It just doesn't do it for me.
Okay, so I think there are, and now I'm directly quoting from Zat. He had a couple of theories as to why people don't like 48. The first one is that you have this learned response that something looks cinematic when it's 24, and to a certain extent, I think that does actually have some validity in that you are used to seeing things that were feature films, and they were...
Yeah, of course.
You know, and so he discounts that, but I actually think that is a bit of it. Though I don't think... And one of the reasons I partly say that is that while most people of my generation I've spoken to had issues with it, most people I speak to under the age of 17 didn't. Now, part of that could just be the age of their eyes, you know, that their younger eyes are less, you know, eye strain kind of issues or whatever, like, you know, I don't know. But it does feel like there's, yeah, that's part of that is to it. And I myself thought that, like, I had an idealized view of film in my head. When I've recently gone back and done some more work on film, I've gone, oh, my God, this is, like, really soft, much softer than I remember it being. I think I've moved my, you know, my goalposts. So I think that's part of it. The second one is this this idea that you've basically – or it's not his second point, but my second point – is this stopped clock illusion thing. This is the idea of static movement in your eyes. So it's an SACCADIC movement in your eyes, which is this phenomenon where your eyes tend to interpolate material as your eyes flicker around the screen, and that 24 tends to work better in that respect because your eyes and your brain are kind of making up some of the missing information. And there are actually studies on this that he quotes that, you know, you lose about, I think it's up to even 40 minutes a day of these tiny little sections of the real world that you're watching is your eyes flickering around the world, and you kind of interpret that. And the reason it's called the stopped clock phenomenon is if you actually first glance at a clock that has a second hand or a second, you know, it's like clicking every second, the first second seems to last a lot longer. And it's because when your eye first goes to it, your brain actually discards the blurred vision that got you there and holds that first image kind of a bit longer in your brain, and then it goes back to kind of real time. And it's a consequence. It's the exact opposite of what you'd think. You think it'd be the last thing you saw before your eyes flicked over, but it's actually the first thing you arrive on. It just seems to last longer. And so this psychological, you know, literally physiological effect is thought to be running better at 24. But to a certain extent, I think creatively, the strongest case I've heard against 48 is actually one that Stu put, Mark, where he was discussing the fact that to really, as a sort of a filmmaker, sort of analyze what a lot of the time he does visually, it's to remove detail to emphasize something, to have a short depth of field, to you know, like raise something in its color and mute its background, to like separate things out, to make them sort of isolated. And that reduction works very well as a filmmaking tool. And the idea of being everything in focus, everything at a higher frame rate, much more detail, doesn't necessarily make for better filmmaking by that sort of criteria. Would you agree?
Yes, and I think it points out a fundamental flaw, perhaps, in stereoscopic viewing, which is essentially that, as I watched this film, I was actually starting to get distracted a bit by depth of field. So sort of watching the film, it's like, well, we've reduced motion blur a lot. We've raised the frame rate. So I'm, you know, there's all this extra information coming visually, and yet we have depth of field. And, you know, of course, in 3D, one thing you can't do that the human eye can do in stereo 3D, one thing you can't do is allow the viewer to shift their focus from the foreground to the background. So in a sense, one thing I was puzzling over as I'm watching it is, you know, if we're going to go this far, and this is kind of like, it goes all the way back to Citizen Kane and what Greg Toland tried to do as a cinematographer, why not eliminate depth? And I think there's a fundamental technical reason not to do that. Isn't that correct?
I mean,
would you agree that that's essentially case?
You could argue that that the more you go in the ride simulation immersion theory, the more you should completely get rid of depth of field, because you're, as you say, getting rid of motion blur, you're getting rid of these other characteristics like flicker. And if you're going to get all the characteristics, why not get rid of that one? And then you get someone like a Stu, like a filmmaker, who says, but hang on a second, I really enjoy all of these tools for making the story, for telling the story using the sort of the palette that is modern filmmaking. Jason, I'm going to ask you a question because it's a curious thing, but if you're going for this immersive world, let's say, for example, that we just assume that it's what he's going for, and you want it to be, you know, look around detailed and far more sort of whatever, how did you rate the grading of this film? Because while everything else was going towards what you might call a real or even super real kind of world, the grading was still pretty stylized. The grading seemed to me one of the biggest aspects that was old school, or rather old school, you know, old school as in 3 years ago. But, you know, like modern filmmaking is to do a lot of power windows, a lot of grading, and this film seemed to have a ton of them, not least of which is Gandalf's face under that bloody hat, and I'll come back to that. And yet, you know, that's sort of like contrary to what we've just been talking about, which is trying to make it, you know, less like you're getting between me and the images.
Yeah, I mean, they definitely... It was a heavy grade. I have to say, from a acquisition standpoint, it's probably the cleanest epic footage I've ever seen. Now, maybe that's because it's 48 frames in stereo and blah, 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 and there's a shitload of CG wrapped around it, but it was clean, super clean. That being said, yeah, it maybe that's Peter Jackson still coming into the idea of the 48 by still seeing it wanting to have the heavier fantasy grade. But it didn't bother me, really. I mean, I've been watching some other things after I saw it, because I saw it like 2 weeks ago. So it's a little less fresh in my mind as if I saw it, you know, like opening day a couple days ago. But I didn't mind the grade. Nothing jumped out at me from the grade.
See, that's really interesting because for me, a lot of things jumped out in the grade. The Gandalf's face under the hat just seemed to be in this huge power window the whole time. And the highlights were rolled off in a way that just screamed, you know, that the guys
narrower range highlight in like
it's like
an interior,
you'd have bright,
or like an exterior.
No, it was an exterior shot, and you'd
you
have
know,
like bright whites. You'd have bright whites that felt like they were rolled, and to a point that I was kind of. If you'd have told me that this had less dynamic range than the Epic that I personally own, I'd have believed you. In the grading of the wide shots, not in the CG, not in the interiors, but in some of those wide shots, yeah, I just felt like, and I was seeing this in a you know really good cinema, and it was a this was actually a VES screening, like it was you know it's like a proper well orchestrated
setup.
Yeah, it's
going to be a proper screening for sure.
I mean, I get that it's a fantasy film. But this is where I'm kind of coming at. Like, it just seems to be a bit disjoint. Like, we've got this fantasy world with very sort of stylized stuff, and then this sort of super realism coming in from the other angle. And I just maybe it's just the recipe didn't have the right balance and harmony
for
me.
The way you feel about the grade working against the film is the way I feel about the high frame rate working against the film for me. So we're sort of saying the same thing, just about two different aspects.
Well, see, what bugged me is that I couldn't even tell you that I had a consistent opinion on the high frame rate. There were points in the high frame rate stuff that I quite enjoyed it. I think it was probably on the exteriors. It was probably, you know, the lit stuff exteriors, and it looked nice. But
yeah, the panoramas were beautiful in high frame rate because you're in wider, smaller motion. You know, the people. And the larger left to right or right to left or whatever motion was so small that you could appreciate the detail in these big wide helicopter shots.
But that
although I did
that
think it was harder on some of that painting detail, particularly Rivendell.
Yeah. I got to say that writing desk scene at the beginning was the real, oh, this is going to be something really different.
Yeah.
And people have even argued that maybe he wanted to set up quieter stuff at the beginning to kind of get your eyes accustomed to it. Because quite a few people I've heard, not you guys, but I've heard people say the first half an hour kind of bothered them, first act bothered them. Then they got into it and they kind of got used to it and then they liked it. For me, there were periods throughout the film that I was aware of the high frame rate. I was not as happy with the eagles at the end as I thought I would have been. And I couldn't put my finger on why that was. So maybe it's time to move to the visual effects. Let's talk about them.
I just want to say one quick thing.
Yep.
The thing I did like about the high frame rate was slow motion. When they use slow motion at high frame rate, which I'm assuming was 96 or 120 against the 48, I thought that looked amazing, personally. Like when Thorne is running with a fire behind him in slow motion at the camera, I was like, oh wow, now I see like a potential reason for the 48. Like it looked really nice, smooth. I don't know if you guys had the same reaction.
I was looking forward to seeing some slow-mo, and the first I saw was the orc battle, and it didn't work for me either. So I've heard really a whole array of opinions. Some people feel like the faster-moving stuff works better in HFR and the slow-moving stuff is problematic. Other people feel the opposite. So clearly, there is some adjusting to be done to see stereo HFR on a big screen. There's just no doubt about it. I just question whether they really got an unintended side effect that basically is part and parcel of it. And I really, you know, to take Stu's point, this is, you know, you are literally getting twice as much information to get 48 frames per second. And that sounds kind of funny to put it that way. But, you know, it could be argued that it's your imagination that fills in the gaps in between as opposed to the darting eye theory. And, you know, an extreme example of the opposite might be something like the Chris Marker film La Jetée that inspired 12 Monkeys, which was all done with still photos. And that's going too far the other way. But, you know, when you think about high frame rate, the things that come to mind are not mythical. You know, mythical, like with NFL films, the big breakthrough for football in America was slow motion and NFL films re-showing all the highlights of a season beautifully shot on film at 24 frames per second. You go all the way back to the dawn of video, and the Twilight Zone did 6 experimental episodes. People who've read my books have heard me trot this example out before. They were total failures, you know, just because they went from 24 FPS film noir on film to 30 on video. So I think that there might have, you know, whether there were benefits or not, is sort of ignores this elephant in the room overall of what did it feel like? Did it feel more like reality TV? Did it feel more like a video game, et cetera? And those are the things that I associate with higher frame rates. So, you know, and then the follow-up question is that my limitation? My kids really didn't have this problem. So they actually, you know, the fact that they didn't really enjoy the film that much was not down to the HFR. I made them come into the other cinema with me, because this is a multiplex, to watch the movie for 5 minutes at regular 24. And I just was querying them whether it looked different to them. And they couldn't really answer. I mean, they're not really trained in this stuff. I've talked to people who are, you know, more junior colleagues who really couldn't. I was talking to a guy today who works with me who wasn't sure if he'd seen the HFR or not. So not everybody's fully attuned to this. So they didn't really notice, you know, what was so different about it. And so I would give you that not everybody is maybe so hung up on this, but there are connotations that are longstanding. And I mean, that's where I would kind of rest the argument.
I've heard an anecdote about some 48 frame tests done for this film, and the room after the test, the room was, you know, who liked it, who didn't, the frame rate, half-ish said no. Then they split the room up by age demographic, and anyone over 25, 30 said we don't like it, and anyone under that said we love it. So, I mean, there's clearly an age and I would say directly correlated to video games, because it looked like a video game. I mean, you know, Peter Jackson is making this movie for 20-year-olds. He's not making it for a 40-year-old.
But see, no, my point is, though, that the criticism that you're leveling is not necessarily a criticism, because it's a creative choice. He doesn't want to look like a old-style film. He wants it to look like this other thing, which is this new thing, which is... It doesn't look like a video game, because a video game, saying that implies the quality of the visuals was, like, dramatically lower than it was.
No, I don't mean that in a derogatory way. I'm just saying a video game gives you insanely higher frame rates, sometimes up to 100 frames a second, depending on what the game is, and that gives you it's a perceptive issue, not a qualitative issue. I'm not saying that to say that it looked like a cutscene from a video game. I just said it had the same feel perceptively, because that's how video games feel. They have that higher frame rate, crisper action, feel.
Yeah, I'm not convinced, watching it,
that I kind of want to see somebody try the low depth of field that I was mentioning, kind of a 300 type approach to a movie like this, like go more stylized.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that this we're talking about when you say it's linked to perception of video games. Like, I don't even know that this isn't actually going to come out, that this is not, you know, your eye over the age of 25 starts to, some part of the physiology in your head actually ages to a point that it's not as enjoyable, you know, because my tastes change. I mean, I could eat much sweeter things when I was younger, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's just a fact. I loved incredibly sweet things as a child that I can't now eat. It's just possible that I remember tasting other things that I just thought were disgusting as a child, and I think are the greatest thing ever. Most of them alcoholic, but you know what I'm saying? Like, it's quite possible this is not just a learnt response.
It's a possibility.
Okay, I need to get onto the VFX, guys, because I think that, you know, apart from the fact it's called the VFX show, I think there is a huge wealth of really interesting stuff here to discuss, and I'd hate to crowd it out just by the 48 frames, even though I do think we could talk for another hour probably about that. But let's deliberately shift our attention to that of the visual effects as much as we can, given that we're seeing them through the glass, if you like, of the 48 frame effect. And Mark, what did you think of the effects overall, and were there some standout scenes that you just really liked?
Oh, certainly. Yes. Would you like me to name them?
I would, and I'm guessing you're going to say Gollum.
Yeah, was maybe the best CG performance I've seen. Period.
Ever. Yeah.
Like he Gollum was so outstanding, compelling in this movie, and we can talk more about how that wasn't just a repeat on past successes. Really compelling. The battle of the I always get the name wrong, the stone cliffs battle. No, that's not the right term.
The stone giants.
In any case, the big rock battle.
Yep.
Was pretty awesome, and you know, there's just lovely work throughout. But those were two of my favorites, and I think I'm forgetting a third. It'll probably come back to me.
I thought the trolls were also really, really well done. I really liked them. But what did you think, Jason?
I agree with Mark preliminarily. The Gollum was – I was really waiting for him, and they delivered. Like, and apparently that was the very first scene they shot for the movie, which is interesting. But they I thought that scene was phenomenal. Just the interaction and the comedy and drama mix was just it's a pretty great scene.
And I think we should say right out of the gate also that in every respect, I think both the Weta team and Andy Serkis deserve points on that, because Andy Serkis is the most experienced motion capture kind of expert in the world. He's second unit director on this as well. But by the same token, the rendering, the characteristics of the skin, the way there were caustics through the eyeballs, I mean, it was just magnificently sort of brought to the screen as well. I mean, it's clearly a joint effort.
Yeah, I would say I would agree also with Mark. The rock giant
stone
battle
giants.
Was stone giant. Whatever was insane. It was amazing because you had no idea that was going to happen. I totally forgot it. Most things from the book. while I was watching it, and I was like, someone's dropping rock. Oh, no, nobody's dropping rocks on him. The rocks are fighting. It was, and the fact that it never, I think it only went wide once. It was really mostly from a down angle looking up these giant rock giants fighting, and the dudes just sort of even lost where they were. You're like, I'm assuming they're still stuck to the leg of a giant somewhere. I thought that was beautiful. And actually, my brother brought this up, and I sort of agree with him, not to go back to the high frame rate, but to bring it up in relation to the visual effects. It worked better in lower light scenes, and maybe that also has to do with the grade and your roll-off issue, but in the Gollum scene and in the Stone Giant scene, it was very dark and moody, and it didn't feel as high frame rate, if that makes sense.
Oh, it totally makes sense. I think if you had an entire film that was Gollum versus the Stone Giants, we'd be claiming that 48 frames was the greatest accomplishment of modern day cinema. I mean, in my mind, I not once started wondering about 48 frames while watching Gollum. And that headbutt scene from the Stone Giants is one of my favorite shots of the entire film. I think it was just a magnificent piece of everything, like lighting, choreography. We led with it as the lead shot, I think, on FX Guide TV when we did the Hobbit coverage. I just love that shot.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is lit well, especially when you feel like you really don't have faces that they, you know, you can see. And we expect fluidity or at least musculature or, if not anything else, some kind of, you know, stretch and flexing in our characters. And these guys were tasked with making rocks look like they were lifting heavy objects and fighting. When you took away, you know, two-thirds of the things you'd normally use to denote two characters fighting. It was just cracker reflection.
I'm sure there will be readers of this book who will claim, oh, that's exactly how I always pictured that being. And I call bullshit because there were so many subtleties in this that were just kind of unexpected. I don't know much about geology. I feel like singing a song now. But one thing is the way that the rocks kind of crumbled, it reminded me, I mean, that the stone was clearly a type like you don't want to climb on because it kind of disintegrates, if you know what I'm talking about.
Like a shale.
Exactly. Thank you. You are a geologist. So,
well, no, it was just so familiar. It was just so well done. It felt familiar.
But even if you said two stone giants headbutting, I think, okay, so two big rocks banging into each other. But it was just so much more interesting than that in terms of what was actually going on, you know, moment to moment.
And I think the thing that probably sold it is you got into the scene with guys on a cliff not expecting a rock stone giant fight. You never really knew if one of them won or not, why they were fighting, if they actually got hurt, what the, you know, is it like two rams fighting, like where they just sort of butt heads and one of them goes away dizzy or what is it? And I think that lack of information helped sell the scene.
Yeah, when that guy falls down at the end, that's like a big shot looking down. You know, it's it's clearly over. But by the same token, you're right. You don't need a lot of backstory. You don't need what's going on. They've stumbled into somebody else's fight, and they get out of it as quickly as they can. And it's great. I mean, you know, you could have overplayed that to the umpteenth. It just worked great. You know, it was really good. But I also, you guys haven't mentioned it. I've mentioned it. I thought the trolls were good. Did anyone comment on the
trolls?
They were
good.
No, I like the trolls. It was really good comedy. I love the default British accent to all, you know,
henchmen, kind of bumbling guys,
fantasy creatures. Yeah. You know, be it Star Wars or Lord of the Rings. I just love that they're these two like, oh, come over here, let's eat the, you know, like big gruff, you know, like panhandling trolls who are just looking for food. I thought that they looked great. I mean, I liked the scene, and when they're talking, when he's talking to them and trying to trick them, and the dwarves don't understand the joke, and they're trying to correct Bilbo. It had Peter Jackson's style for sure.
Mark, talk to me. You said we could discuss how Gollum was different. Let's just do that because, I mean, Gollum was just superb. But how did you feel? Because he needed to look the same as the previous Gollum to a certain extent.
Yeah, Right. Well, I haven't gone back and compared, so that would have been good homework for the show. I suddenly, you know, it's weird, Mike, but I almost felt like I was watching David Bowie play this role. Like, and, you know, that might not be everybody's favorite actor, but it actually gave me a newfound respect for David Bowie's acting, even, because it was really over the top in such a human way. And, you know, this is a moment for this character where he's kind of at his most twisted, right? He's been with this ring for so long, and he's literally kind of schizophrenic. And I think that where it really came out for me was in the eyes, which, of course, are going to be the acid test of any virtual character. And I would say, you know, the expression around the eyes and also the commitment to drama, which, you know, I would credit a lot of that to Andy Serkis to begin with. As you say, I mean, his ability to act for this medium, I mean, he really is the most experienced motion capture actor. And even though this wasn't pure motion capture, it was a lot closer to that than it was the last time around. I mean, this time around, instead of shooting him on a film, they had him in a headset with a little camera to actually capture his facial expressions at themselves at very high resolution, such that they could get much better data and essentially leave the hand animation to, I think, just add emphasis and kind of micro detail. And this to me felt like a pretty happy medium between the three, between the awesome acting skills, the improved mocap, and then the massaging by skilled animators.
And I'm going to say lighters and texture
yeah.
artists. Because
oh, God, yes.
This was
absolutely.
Just...
Absolutely.
I mean, I think...
But also the fact that Andy Serkis could act directly with Martin Freeman...
Yeah, on a set, yeah.
On a stage, and because he does the voice, also, you know, to literally be able to act a scene, forgetting the tech, and literally perform off each other is a huge, you know, leap forward.
Yeah. I mean, for me, he was the crowning achievement of the film from a technical point of view that, you know, it was the character, the shots, and the, you know, it had emotional weight, it had actual acting, it had drama, humor. Like, it was just a delight to watch all of that. Okay, let's swing back, if we can, to the opening of the film and the technique that they deployed in a few places, but it's most evident in a very long shot in the opening sequence where the dwarves are getting stuff out of the pantry and they're taking it through and one of them offers Gandalf a drink. The shot lasts about 4,000 frames and was shot, for those that don't know, on two stages simultaneously. So what happens is that most of the dwarves on a scaled set that would make that correct for the dwarves is that they're being directed by Peter Jackson. They're doing everything they want. But the camera is being completely mocap recorded and actually driving simultaneously a robotic camera on the next sound stage, which is a full green screen stage, now scaled to be smaller so that Ian, the actor, is bumping into the roof in the way the dwarves can walk through a door. He hits it. And so when you take those two images and live put them together on set, you basically get a comp that has Ian in the middle of the dwarves and he is larger height than them. So I hope I've explained that adequately. So you've got a 4,000 frame shot there and the camera moves from the pantry to the where they're having their meal, back in, Gandalf comes out, bumps his head on his actual overhead light fixture and then accepts a drink from a dwarf that, of course, he doesn't accept because it's on a completely different soundstage, and that's the end of the shot, 4,000 frames. They use that technique again for other things and other places, but that's probably the singularly most impressive one-off shot because it lasts for so long and you really get a chance to look at it. I'll start with you, Mark. Did you buy the shot and did it feel like a comp?
Absolutely. You just remembered the third thing I was fishing for earlier. I was blown away in a different sense by that shot because I had to remind myself after seeing that there was no way in hell they could have done it with the same techniques they used the last time, which were much more forced perspective, you know, the kind of tricks that actually totally break in stereo. So they had that going against them. And they came up with really a pretty ingenious solution, which required, you know, a lot of talent on the behalf of the central actor, which clearly they had Ian McKellen, because he, you know, would, I guess, rehearse the scenes with all that interaction with them and then replayed it with the same timing. And then in the cases where they, you know, were actually literally grazing him and moving his costume and so on, obviously they had to add in, you know, details there. But the fundamentals, I mean, it's such an ingenious solution and really pretty seamless. You know, I have to say a lot of the work in this film, and this is where I would love to go back and see it with more of it without the HFR, because a lot of it looked compy and not in a way where I'm saying, oh, there were matte lines or there were flaws in the comps, but where there were deliberate choices not to match foreground and background to create a drama between the two, which to me didn't work that well in HFR and I think would work well lower, my bias. This sequence didn't suffer from any of that. So, I mean, obviously there's no comping problems at Weta. That's not what I'm saying. But if you're asking me, was this well comped? Oh, yeah, it was an absolute tour de force.
And you, Jason?
I was really looking forward to this scene, actually, because I had heard about it from a friend who was on set about a year ago, because we were talking about the high frame rate and the stereo, and we both reminded each other that you can't do forced perspective in 3D in stereo, and I was really interested, and then he explained to me basically what you had just explained to me, and I was really curious to see how that would work. And I agree with you. I think that was flawless, and I don't think anyone who was a normal film goer who wasn't interested in the technical aspects of it would ever question the comp and the performance and even the digital tweaks, like you were saying, Mark, to cloth and other things that needed to be added to cell interactions. I think it's easily a high point from a technical standpoint in the film.
Yes. Yeah. No. I think it was absolutely a high point. We interviewed Rhys Davies, right, who played the dwarf in the Fellowship films.
Yeah.
Yeah.
John Rhys-Davies.
We interviewed John in a hotel room here in Sydney, and he started talking to us about that. Like, oh, it's amazing. They just dialed it up on set on blah blah blah. And of course, my ears completely pricked up because I was like, what's this? I don't know about this. And it was really interesting hearing his point of view because he had to act in the previous film without that kind of stuff. I will say that, and this is me not, I'm not trying to sound like I'm gossiping, but from reports that have come out, I don't know this firsthand, but I did read an interview where Sir Ian McKellen said that he actually cried the first time he did that, not in a good way, because he just was completely alone on a green screen stage. And I think that the team then went to work and produced variations in it that allowed cameras and eye lines and stuff and to give him more feedback, and they worked very hard to make it a more actor-friendly setup. Of course, it's a very director-friendly setup by having both actors or teams of actors in one case on the same video split, but if you're the one guy that's on the green screen stage with no one else around, and apparently Ian let fly about how much he wasn't enjoying this. Well, the mic was hot, which is how they kind of found out about it, and they fixed it. Now, if you actually talk to other people and read other interviews, you'll actually hear them say, yeah, at the outset there were a couple of issues to get around, but then they got it working well. And I think in every case they're referring to that, not technical stuff, that I think they really did work hard to try and make it good for the actors as well as for the director and the technical crew. The thing about doing that is it is very similar to what they did in one sense with that forced perspective in the first one. We remember in the first Hobbit film they had a camera that panned around and they did this amazing kind of motion control moving of the chairs that the actors were sitting on and their eye line, so it looked like they were forced perspective in the same shot. Now, that was technology that didn't require the actors to be in separate rooms, just not looking at each other. But I do think that it produced sensationally good results. That being said, let's not take away from the artist that then manipulated it, because I understand from actually having now firsthand spoke to the artist, because we were over in New Zealand for about a week doing stuff on this film and covering it, it took them a year to pull off that 4,000 frame shot. So somebody worked on that shot literally for a better part of 12 months because of all the interactions and swapping and cloth and everything else. This was not like an easy shot. I could be wrong in saying that, but I'm pretty sure I'm not. And that's good to know. But at the end of the day, as you say, if you watch that scene, no one is going, wow, that doesn't look real, or, you know, that looks kind of fake. It just played super, super well. I think it was a really shining technical moment. And, you know, sometimes you have to jump through hoops to get those, but they obviously used it more than once because there were a lot of scenes that required this. And I think they used it again on the trolls. And good on them. But, man, it's an ingenious solution. And, you know, it just works really, really well. But, you know, you've got to get the setup for it because, let's face it, like running a camera slave off the other one and scaled, it's not a quick fix on set.
No, that's a really excellent point. And this show of all is the one where we should really recognize that kind of effort. I mean, it's the same way you were saying about Gollum earlier. I'm looking back at some stills of him. And throughout, I think the moisture on going back to just some of the CG work on this, the moisture in his eyes, some of these details, and definitely my comments about what was required to finish the shot were not meant to trivialize the crazy amount of work they would take to make a shot that long, work with that much interaction. I mean, it's along the lines of what won the Golden Compass and Oscar a few years ago.
Yeah. So talk to me about whether or not, you know, just in terms of the visual effects in the other parts of the film, you missed there not being miniatures. Because one of the things that we would have discussed if we were doing this, you know, a decade or two ago and we'd talk about Lord of the Rings, we'd have discussed the bigatures. It was a big thing at the time. They made these enormous sets. They were flying around as obviously miniatures, but they were so big, they got the nickname bigatures. Not happening this time because of stereo. It's CG sets. Jason, did you feel like you missed those miniatures, or did you feel like the various locations they went to were, you know, beautifully realized, albeit digitally?
Yeah, it didn't jump out to me. I mean, the amount of detail in the backgrounds and environments was mind-blowing. I think I said to you in an earlier conversation that the work, not that Weta is already at ILM's level as far as I'm concerned, and ILM's, you know, pretty much the tops and for a lot of things, but this just, I mean, the amount of detail and rendering and lighting and the whole pipeline for the CG and the environments and all the work in general, but especially the environments, is mind-blowing. The Goblin King's lair, the Rivendell, I'm blanking on a bunch of the other scenarios, but it's just the amount of realism and flexibility that it gave them not doing the miniatures and bigatures, I think worked to their favor.
So, I mean, the set that they would have done,
I didn't miss it per se.
Yeah, the set they would have done.
I don't think there was anything that I wished was, oh, I wish that was a miniature mountain.
I mean, I think the one they would have done is that prologue sequence where the dragon attacks. Obviously, you don't see the dragon, but you see the fire from him. That would have screamed out as a classic bigature or whatever, because it was a little town and there was like the big gate in the mountain, and that's the sort of thing that you could have imagined them doing. And you were sort of flying over it, which is what a camera on a Milo rig would be able to do. What do you think, Mark?
Yeah, there was some of the same knocks against the goblin lair or whatever you want to call it. And throughout this film, I have a trouble remembering which is a troll and which is a goblin because of the movie Troll 2, which got it wrong. So in the goblin's lair, you know, there were those crazy camera moves that have gotten knocked for being pretty unrealistic. I mean, they were impossible camera moves. But, you know, the previous film had those with the bigatures, so it's not even like the two are really related. Just in this case, that there were moves that you couldn't have done with a bigature because you were going right through stuff.
I didn't like the end of the Goblin Town sequence where the bridge collapses and they surf it down a side and then ends up at the bottom. And then, of course, the Goblin King dead lands on top of them. Loved the ending with the Goblin King dead landing on them. Thought that was great. And that whole kind of, you must be joking. But that surfing down the side of the interior rock face, just to me, just, I don't know, it's just that, if I had to name a shot that felt wrong because, not that Weta didn't pull it off, but because you were never going to make that shot believable, that would be my shot.
Yeah, that's not specifically a miniature issue, though. That's just an execution, story execution issue.
But I was just moving on. Yeah, I mean, I don't really miss the miniatures, but that was the only, as you brought up, the camera moves. I mean, you can have flying camera moves with eagles, and you can have flying camera moves when you're just doing heroic shots over Middle Earth. But inside the goblin town, it just felt like it got out of control. And it, I had similar issues when it looks almost like a bit like a video game. And I think the first or the second of the original Lord of the Rings films, when they were running from a bunch of, I think it was goblins, and in the section of one of the underground cities, and there were a huge row of towers or pillars, and they were running around them.
That was Moria.
Moria, right.
Moria.
And I didn't like that. I thought the digital double work was much better in this film than we've seen before, and you kind of expect that. These guys are really good at it, so I'm not criticizing that. It's just, it just seemed like such a dumb thing to get these characters to, you know, rock surf, and I didn't buy it. I didn't also buy them dropping through the floor in the cave and then acting like sort of pinball machines being loaded up in before they ended up in the basket at the very beginning of that whole sequence. Again, it was just, well, you know, you're going to break a bone or you're going to at least have massive lacerations or concussion. I mean, just at no point did I just think you can take characters that we sort of felt quite close to and just bounce them around like that without expecting there to be some consequences. Or if you do, then you just sort of kept me out of the film and I'm not so into it. I guess maybe it's my age, but I just didn't.
I just totally forgot about that part, honestly. You just reminded me.
Do you know what I mean? And what did you think about the end sequence with the very stupid place to grow a tree at the end of a rocky cliff and the fire and the attack including the eagles? Mark, what do you think?
I thought it was okay. I mean, I think it was well executed as far as, you know, all the CG that had to be done with the tree. You know, story-wise overall, I think with this movie, I'm looking forward to kind of this phantom edit where a lot of this stuff is just cut down to size once all three films are out. And I think as a tighter sequence, that would have worked better. Because the wolves or whatever you call them were not as interesting as antagonists as earlier, you know, as you said, the trolls were really your best bad guys and they were fun to watch.
What about you, Jason?
I think that was he, I forget his name, but the white orc. Is he
the one-handed guy?
The guy who's coming after, whatever. He probably looked the most CG to me because he had all these the weird like cuts or sort of looked like rock breaks in his chest and stuff. He's the most monstery, you know, character that would actually talk and, you know, in a more menacing sense. That the trolls were kind of like, they were menacing but they were kind of like bumbly guys. The sequence didn't work for me because halfway through the movie, I kind of was like, wait a second. Gandalf's a wizard. He's not doing very much wizardy stuff that could probably, you know, help them through these. Like, he's dangling off the end of a tree that's going to fall. He's a wizard. He's got to be able to solve that problem with some sort of spell of protection or a bubble or some sort of, you know, like zap the wolves away or something other than calling for eagles. Now, I don't know the eagles specific powers.
Yeah. Well, and then you have the Deus Ex Machina that shows up.
He was still
the wolves are called wargs, by the way, to just get it right for the nerds. Okay. And the fire, you know, was done with a system that is Weta's own, the synapse system. And it was good enough that I didn't notice it. There were other scenes, again, where I didn't think the CG fire held up as well. I think this was probably one of the best for that. There were a lot of sparks and embers.
This is where that my slow motion shot came in of Thorin Oakenshield having his Oakenshield to battle the white orc. That's where I thought the slow motion fire and slow motion in general worked really nicely.
You know, they developed a whole new feather system for the eagles. So why is it that I don't like the eagles? Why is it? I mean, the plumage feather system they used on the Great Eagles produced, I think, good feathers. And I think there were really, really good feathers done in the Owls of the Galhul by Animal Logic. I mean, they've had some of the best feather stuff I've ever seen, especially the slow motion stuff in the rain sequences in that film. But does anyone... Because when they were flying away and they were safe and they were not pulling people out of trees, it just felt oddly odd. You know, does anyone else think that?
You think it was an animation problem?
I think more of a lighting problem, if I was going to say anything, actually.
One thing I'll say about that is it's remarkable to line these up against the older films. Most of the creatures are more colorful. In that CG just used to look grayer, even as good as it was. It was more monochromatic. And I think they were a little bit more in that direction. So to me, we were even arguing after the film, were those eagles or were they hawks? You know, and of course, according to the book, they're eagles, but they didn't have, they lacked the grandeur of eagles, at least if you're talking about like, you know, a bald eagle or something that's got white plumage. I mean, I think there are eagles that are gray eagles, sure. But in any case, I'm taking a wild stab that maybe it was something along those lines when you talk about the lighting.
They were my least successful for me personally, and you know, God knows I couldn't do any better job, but they were the least successful creature for me, the eagles. I expected them to be, because the kind of finale of that ep, awesome. I think the dragon in the next one is probably going to be my favorite creature ever, because like that one eye and everything else that we saw.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, wow, that looked spectacularly good.
He's voiced by Benedict Cumberbatch.
Yes, which is interesting given that his Sherlock partner is running around with big feet. A regular Sherlock Holmes reunion.
And he's the bad guy in the new Star Trek movie.
Hey, help me out here. Did anyone spot Stephen Colbert, or for that matter...
He's not in this episode yet. He's okay. In the second one.
Good. And what's his name from IQ?
Well, Brett from Flight of the Conchords was in this one.
As what?
He was Elrond's like forward, the guy who came over and was like, Elrond will see you now.
Oh really?
And I was like, hey, that's Brett.
I loved Brett. I'm so sorry I missed that. I think Brett's marvelous. Stephen Fry was apparently in it.
I think he's in the next one also.
Okay. I thought Barry Humphries did a good voice performance for the Goblin King. I was worried that maybe... I mean, I think Barry Humphries is just a comic genius, but I was worried I was going to see Barry Humphries, not a Goblin King, and I saw a Goblin King, so I thought that was good. Just speaking on acting there for a second. And, of course, it had Cate Blanchett, who is the greatest actor of our generation.
Mm-hmm. I'll watch her read the phone book. I
would watch her just do anything.
Yeah. I thought from a digital double standpoint, the only one that stuck out to me was at that very end, there's a wide shot of, I think, Gandalf dropping off the eagle onto the rock.
Starts with CG and goes to live action?
Well, it's just in the wide shot, so it's only CG.
Okay.
Where he, like, his motion, it looked like I'm not saying this to be mean, it felt like Lego Lord of the Rings game. You know, like the little guy just drops off. It's the only one I noticed was just a little physics bug in the way he sort of wiggles off the eagle.
I will say this from a stereo point of view, I thought the stereoscopic use and everything else, especially in the Goblin Town, was terrific, because to get those actors interspersed so successfully with so many other characters and to move between live action actors, digital doubles and synthetic characters around the actors, which are being hustled and bustled by actual actors that are going to be removed later. I mean, the stereo just was faultless through that section, and it was quite, you know, used to quite strong effect. I don't know if there's any other sequences from a stereo point of view, but from a technical point of view, stereo-wise, I thought the Goblin Caves was a huge win.
I thought the stereography overall was really probably the best I've seen, but I couldn't tell if that was because of the high frame straining or just because it was really well composed?
I didn't like so much the fact, I do prefer movies like Up that draw you into the frame rather than pushing things out of it. And this didn't go all Robert Rodriguez on that, but it did have a lot of the foreground action forward of frame. And, you know, that combined with the HFR and the fact that often, I mean, there were shots in which, you know, the foreground and background lighting were very cinematically not matched. And those are the ones that I'm saying, you know, in that, and I blame HFR for this, but they just copy to me. I mean, even shots that you knew there was very little compositing, which there were very few in this film. I mean, there were a lot of composited shots in this movie. You know, normal scenery didn't hold up as well to a lot of people, including me, with HFR. So it's kind of a weird knock that I really think I wouldn't have, again, at a lower frame rate, and I'm willing to accept that that's my limitation.
One of the guys here in the office criticized heavily the rabbit sled scene just before they find the, you know, get, before they duck down the hole into in Rivendell. I thought the rabbit scene was a great win for an audience in the forest and in the sequences leading up to the open fieldy kind of stuff. But what do we think about once it got out into the open for that I'll distract them runaway sequence?
Apparently a lot of that forest set was actually a set.
Because I thought they looked great there, the rabbits. I was just curious about what you thought about when they got out in the open. You know what I'm talking about? It's the sequence right before they...
Right before he shows up to the dwarves, right?
Yeah. Well, so, no, when they're trying to get away and the Gandalf will find the secret passage that gets them to the Hidden Valley.
Right.
And so, you know, Radagast is going one way out in the open and they're running the other way and then he'll come around a corner and they'll bump into each other kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it didn't... I don't...
Because that was heavily criticized here in the office as being... because it was a very, very fast kind of moving sequence. And there's this phenomenon that we've touched on already, which is sometimes people perceive high frame rate stuff as actually being kind of sped up. And I experienced that myself. I don't think it was the wrong speed, but it just I had this sort of momentary flash of why is it going in fast forward?
Okay. I had that sensation only at the very beginning, the first action, and then I got over it. So it didn't recur for me in that sequence. So...
Yeah, that fast forward motion, actually, if I recall, I only sort of felt it in live action sequences, not with a lot of heavily comped stuff and with CG. It seemed like it was more of like, and I think some of it may have been pointed out by editing also, because just the edits felt rushed, even though I know they weren't. It's just the pacing totally changed when I felt that phenomenon. For lack of a better term.
Hmm. Okay, so is there anything we didn't like that... I feel like a couple of things that didn't work for me. What about you, Mark? Anything you sort of thought, just generally speaking, leaving the high frame rate out of it, just thought, ooh.
Well, you've touched on some of the color grades, and I have a feeling you're going to go back to that. So I will go back to a point I just touched on, which is that a couple of the wide shots of Rivendell just really look like mad paintings. And so they got really soft and flat. And then one of them had quite a bit of water detail in it, which was clearly CG water detail. And everything else around it looked kind of painted. So those kind of stood out for me, especially since some of the first glimpses you get of it are in that wide, you know, in the distance kind of thing.
Yeah. I there was something about Rivendell that didn't really... Well, it was interesting. There were some shots and they were spectacularly good. That night shot when they were holding out, you know, you're in luck, you happen to have come at exactly the right time to read this map.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that and then and even the medium wides were great.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I'm really only talking about the almost atmospheric haze far in the distance, miles away kind of shots of it.
Yeah. And what about you, Jason?
I'm trying to think something I didn't like. specifically that we haven't talked about. Let's say one thing we didn't talk about was, which is sort of related to Gollum in that it was a repeated character or look from the other movies, was when Bilbo had the ring on.
Right. Yeah, that kind of the dreamlike wispy, state. Yeah.
Netherworld look that I kind of liked, although I immediately felt myself waiting to see the Eye of Sauron, right? Because every, you know, every time Frodo put it on, it was he needed to put it on to get away, but then Sauron would sort of get a better handle on where the ring was, and that wasn't in this movie, obviously. So I had to get over that sort of initially and just know that he could be safe in walking around invisible. I kind of liked because the frame was so washy and weird and messy, not to bring the HFR back into it, but it sort of made that work more for me. Not, and I didn't mean messy in a bad way, but messy like in that it had like the kind of swirly, weird, distorted image. I think I was talking to my brother about it. He brought up that he really liked the way that they sort of went with that.
Yeah, I mean, that did need to relate to the other films because we'd established what happened in those other films. And even though when the other films came out, I thought, oh, that looks a bit like somebody's been playing with the digital video effects plug-in draw. It was a valid use of plugins, if it was a plugin, which I'm sure it wasn't. And, you know, you had to sort of stay true to it. Mark, let's swing back then just to finish up on the grading. So I said that I had problems with a couple of things in the grade, and you echo those remarks, is that right?
Yeah.
Talk to me about what you did or didn't like.
Well, you pointed out the unusual grade of Gandalf underneath his hat, which I don't, you know, to someone who doesn't know to recognize the power window might not stand out as much. But it sounds like it stood out to you, correct?
Yeah, because it just seemed like there was some massively unmotivated light source. His exteriors were just, he was lit up like there was holding a big white reflector that happened to be an oval shape and was aimed right at his face.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was a grade. It was absolutely a grade. This was not, because I have an enormous amount of respect for the cinematography and the cinematographer of this film, and this was not... this was not coming from that. This was, you could just tell this was a grading issue. You can't do that with a, you know, like a traditional lighting.
Right. And I think that's maybe an extreme of something that I felt was there a lot in this film where there were just slightly impossible light situations going on that may go along with the look of a fantasy film. And they certainly allow you to create a very dramatic shot in terms of having dark darks and light lights and having your foreground figure really pop out. But I thought it was too much some of the time.
Well, overall, what do we think? This is going to be a film in contention for Oscar attention. The state at the moment is it's you know, one of the 10 in consideration leading up to the Bake Off. The Bake Off is going to happen January 3rd, so we may not get another show out before then. So what do we think? Do you think Hobbit will move through from the Bake Off to the 5 nominee list?
On the strength of Gollum, potentially. And it's going to rekindle the whole Andy Serkis, I deserve an Oscar for acting. I mean, I don't know if he'll make that claim, but
I'll make a claim that he deserves to be in the running for
discussion of the actor's role versus the technician's.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's in the running for tremendous contribution through the form of acting, though he was also second unit director, so he contributed in a lot of ways to this film. But yeah, I don't have any problem, though, with also pointing out that it wasn't just Andy Serkis, right? Like that it's a collaborative effort.
So do we think also that the fact that it's stereo 48 frames visual effects work will give it a boost outside of the what is, regardless of things we did or didn't like, obviously some phenomenal work in the film from a visual effects standpoint?
Look, I think from my personal point of view, I want to live in a world where a filmmaker like Peter Jackson tries new things. And if anyone was to hold it against them that they tried something new, that would be petty and ridiculous. And no one for a split second wouldn't acknowledge that there's a lot more work to do and a lot harder work to do. And they're increasing our general pool of talent in ways that, you know, are important. But I don't know that 48 will work for them in terms of being deemed to be a huge success. I just think it'd be stunning if they weren't, you know, nominated because of such a great body of work.
Yeah.
Hey, let me get your opinions while I've got you because, you know, as this is going to air, we're between Christmas and New Year, so there is only, like, days before the January 3rd. And obviously January 3rd isn't when the nominations are announced. It's January 10th. But if right now, here we are in the last dying moments of 2012, the beginning of 2013, if you had to pick those five and you haven't been to the Bake Off yet, what are your five moving forward?
Oh, wow, I suck at these. My mind goes blank when I try to think of man on the street list questions.
Well, this is a man on the list, though, because
use my call a friend and call Todd Vaziri?
Yeah, you can't. 50-50 split. Okay. Well, let me make some suggestions to you based purely on my personal opinion. I make nothing. I don't know anything. But my personal opinion, I would say The Hobbit goes through for sure. I say Life of Pi goes through for sure. Avengers goes through for sure. Those three,
yeah,
just they're a lock. If they don't get nominated, I'm running a story about how shocked I am that neither of those three were nominated. I would say that Dark Knight Rises will also go through to the five, partly because I think there's a wealth of respect for the work that Dean Egg did with Chris Nolan. Even though it's not as big a film from a visual effects point of view as some others, I think it will still resonate with the Academy members. But then of the remaining six, which gets that fifth slot is...
What are the remaining six?
Well, you've got things like... Cloud Atlas, which I think is awesome, but maybe not as widely seen as others. I mean, we haven't done a show on that yet. Let me just give you a heads up. Love that film. Spider-Man, Men in Black 3, I believe. I'm just quoting from memory now. Luckily, there's a site called FX Guide that has these kind of things. So, Amazing Spider-Man, Cloud Atlas, Dark Knight Rises, Hobbit, John Carter, Life of Pi, Avengers, Prometheus, Skyfall, and Snow White and the Huntsman. A number of people have said that they thought Skyfall would go through. I'm just keen to see what you guys think. So, I'm saying...
Snow White had some nice work in it.
Absolutely.
Anamorphic and whatnot.
Skyfall could go through just because it's the Academy thing of wanting to recognize a movie like that, maybe not having other better categories to do it in.
I have to say, I think Prometheus had spectacular work. The work both that Weta did on the skin stuff, but also just that room with the maps was extraordinary. Really,
and even the crashing ship at the end coming
really
back
nice.
Down was pretty awesome.
Really nice destruction sims. I mean, it's so hard with visual effects, isn't it, to separate between the film and the effects work, which is why one would think maybe John Carter would get beat up because the film wasn't as well received. That being said, again, you know, really, really nice work. I don't think we would point to any of the films in that list as having a big dud. There's not one in that list that you go, that doesn't deserve to be there.
Right.
At this stage of the 10. But, yeah, so I'm going to say that, because, I mean, literally I think you could roll a dice on Spider-Man, Atlas, Prometheus, Skyfall, and Huntsman. Probably John Carter will just suffer, as I say, from this perception that the film wasn't hugely successful. But I would have thought that Hobbit, Pi, and Avengers are a lock to be three of the five. Do you want to pick the other ones for you guys?
Well, I haven't seen Cloud Atlas, Life of Pi, or Skyfall.
Okay, well, let me just say, I'm actually envious of you.
Yeah, just pick two out of those three,
Like a brain. Use my brain like a brain.
I'm envious you haven't had that delightful experience yet because you have some really delightful experiences in front of you.
Yeah.
True.
I would love to have more.
As my friend Dave would say, I am sitting on gold.
Yeah. People have been rude on Cloud Atlas. Let me just say, from a visual effects point of view, wow, like it's worth saying, like just really.
I think I said to you again in another conversation that actually the only thing that's making me want to see that is Tom Tykwer. So,
yep.
I would probably make it on there because it's sort of a more esoteric film that, you know, I mean, Prometheus may, but that was sort of like a pseudo esoteric film.
But you know, don't forget, you were talking about the group that picks these films for nominees are the peers of the people that made these films. They're not the General Academy. It's a completely different ballgame when we go to who's doing the final vote.
Because they got to take the film as a story and the whole thing, and not just the work, right? I mean, for the Bake Off,
it's a complicated issue, isn't it?
It is because that's really technical people voting, so they won't always do that. Ultimately, for the Oscar, that matters a lot more.
Exactly. I mean, if you thought that the subsurface scattering in Spider-Man was the best thing that you've ever seen, you might reward it even if you didn't think that Spider-Man needed to be remade. You know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, that's the shot for Prometheus right there.
Yeah. And Huntsman was a real surprise. So again, you know, if you've got lower expectations and then you over-deliver, that leaves a good impression. I mean, Hobbit had to knock it out of the ballpark to even get, you know, kind of a nod as, they went well, because the expectation of a Weta on a Hobbit project was so high. I mean, there's no one thought that Weta was going to do a bad job, right? Now, I'm not saying I thought that anyone was going to do a bad job on Huntsman. It just wasn't a well-known sort of product going in. It wasn't a sort of, we weren't all sitting around going, I can't wait till Huntsman comes out. Oh my God, finally they're making Snow White.
I mean, I'll bet Cloud Atlas gets in.
Really?
Because it probably won't get a lot of other nominations, I don't think.
Mark?
I don't know, it's a little bit of a battle of which track record veteran now doing a somewhat mixed received, and I would throw Hobbit in. I mean, the reception for Hobbit has been more mixed than it was on the Lord of the Rings films. Not bad, and not as mixed as, say, Prometheus. But in all cases, you're doing the Academy thing of paying due homage and respect to the skills of some of the best people we've got making these kind of movies and delivering, but maybe not delivering the obvious way that, you know, the Avengers, say, did in Hollywood terms.
Yeah, I mean, I think Dan Glass delivered in Cloud Atlas big time. But the thing is, you know, again, just will everyone have seen it? I mean, it just hasn't gone down to such a big audience. And it's hard to vote for something if you haven't seen it, just because, you know, for all the right reasons, really. You just, you know, feel like I'm not in a good position to vote for it, even if you go to the Bake Off, which is only going to show like 10 minutes of stuff. I will say this, I'm way looking forward to doing some VFX shows on things like Life of Pi and Cloud Atlas if we can, because I think that the work that the artists did on that deserve attention. But there is one other group of people that I'd like to draw attention to on this film, if we just leave that subject for a second, which is the costume and makeup team on The Hobbit, because I think the costumes were spectacularly good and the dwarves were just beautifully done and their makeup was just spectacularly well executed. At no point did I feel like I was seeing people in, you know, rubber suits or rubber masks. And while it isn't strictly VFX, I know, I personally was really impressed by the work on The Hobbit, and I just want to give them a bit of a shout out.
Some of the best prosthetics ever on those dwarves, and the fact that they had to do 13 of them and get them all ready for the scenes on the same day.
Can I say that I think it's Boren, if I remember the names, the guy with the big mustache and the weird hat.
Fatigue,
every time I looked at him, I thought he just looked like George Harrison.
Okay. You know?
Well, I couldn't get Rambolon out of my head the whole afternoon while I was researching for this.
Yeah. I also have to say that all the Lord of the Rings and this movie are the most like heavy metal movies ever. Like, they could easily play Slayer like as a dragon is flying over the mountain, and it would totally
even
work.
More so than
I would like to see the dwarves doing air guitar. I absolutely would. Well, as to who gets to hold on to that Oscar and call it their precious, we'll have to wait and see. But I want to thank you guys for being on the show this week. I want to thank you for sticking your neck out and discussing some very complicated stuff. It'd be really easy to do this show and just take wild sort of sarcastic swipes at high frame rate. And I'm glad we didn't do that. Even though you didn't like it, I just think it deserves an adult discussion, as do many things in this world. Mark, thanks so much for being here. Where can people find you?
Well, I'm contemplating a rebrand because I'm getting a little tired of Flow Seekers. So I think by the time this show airs, I'm going to switch my Twitter handle, believe it or not, to Mark Christensen, my name, But since that's too long for Twitter, we're going to go with Mark Christensen, but without any of the vowels. Does that make sense to you guys? I'm trying not it out really. On you before I no. pull
is
the
it like,
switch on
is
this.
It like, it's like Flickr or MGMT?
I can't,
even further than
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I can't even spell on a good day. Jason, what about you?
I do still have vowels in my Twitter handle, and it's Jason Diamond, one word, or the site I have with my brother, thediamondbros.com.
Well, hopefully you guys had all had a good Christmas and got all the presents that you wanted, and you are looking forward to 2013 as we are. Just travel safe. This is obviously a time of year where you know, you really need to do that. We hope to have you all join us again in 2013. Just want a big thank you to our team behind the scenes. In fact, you guys can join me in this because, like, Todd has been literally working nights in his day job, as it were, and been sending stuff for us to do on research. Matt, who's doing the editing, Ian, who's been doing so much work in sort of helping to coordinate when these things happen. The whole team here does a great job, as do the guys out of Chicago that run the servers and put everything stuff together. So it's always a collective effort. I want to thank all of our hosts over 2012, because these guys don't get paid. This is not this is just, they do this out of the generous of their hearts, and we really appreciate them. So let me thank you two as the stand-in surrogates for the entire cast that hosts we've had this year, and say we really appreciate it so much, guys. Thank you, Mark and Jason, and everyone that's been on the show. Until next time, I'm Mike Seymour. See you guys.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright 2012, FX Guide, LLC.